High pressure will be the dominant weather feature across the Midwest over the next few days. As the system moves into the mid-Atlantic states today, the region will experience strong winds from the south. The southerly flow will bring us moderating temperatures. The next chance for rain will come late Saturday into Sunday as a cold front presses southeast across Illinois and toward the Ohio River. High temperatures today will range from the 30s, the upper 30s, across northwestern Wisconsin to the low 60s across southwestern Missouri. Overnight low temperatures will range from the low 30s across central Wisconsin to the mid 40s across central Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny and windy. Look for a high of 50. The wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35. Tonight, partly cloudy, not as cool. The low 37. The wind will be out of the south from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, warmer, and windy. We'll see a high of 57. The wind will be from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance for showers. The low 45. The wind out of the southwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. We'll see a high in the low 50s. The wind from the north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Sunday night through Monday night, mostly cloudy. Lows Sunday night and Monday night around 40 with the high Monday in the low 50s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in a narrow range, ranging from the upper 40s to 50 degrees, most locations reporting sunshine. At Rockford and O'Hare, 48 degrees, 49 at Bloomington, 47 at Mattoon. Carbondale reported 50 degrees. It was 47 at South Bend, Lafayette, and Indianapolis, 48 at Terre Haute, and Evansville checked in with 50 degrees. Willard Airport reported 48 degrees at the top of the hour. The sky mostly sunny. The dew point, 18. The relative humidity, 30%. The wind out of the south at 28 miles per hour with gusts to 39. And the barometric pressure, 30.12 and falling. And at 12:39, 49 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu appeared before a House Oversight Subcommittee yesterday to defend his agency's decision to lend $500 million in federal money to Solyndra, a company that made solar panels and is now bankrupt. That loan was approved by the Obama administration in 2009, though the program was started under President Bush. The company is the subject of numerous federal investigations. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more.
What the four-and-a-half-hour hearing laid bare was that it's almost impossible to ask questions about Solyndra without wading into deep political divides. Here is Subcommittee Chairman Cliff Stearns, a Florida Republican, in the opening round of questions to Secretary Chu.
Were you aware of that, that Solyndra was a bad bet? Yes or no?
This is not, sir, this is not a yes or no question. Let me explain the context of what this email was about. Okay.
After gathering some 250,000 pages of evidence, Republicans have said the White House tried to rush through Solyndra's loan for its political benefit. They said the Energy Department restructured the company's loan to benefit a big Obama fundraiser, and have suggested the agency even tried to postpone layoffs at Solyndra until after the 2010 midterm elections. Democrats shot back, saying Republicans ignored evidence showing the administration did not try to influence the Energy Department. California Democrat Henry Waxman said, in fact, Republicans were using Solyndra as a platform to advance their own agenda.
The agenda of congressional Republicans is clear. Do everything possible to maintain our addiction to fossil fuels and cripple clean energy companies that could compete with oil and coal.
For his part, Chu categorically denied having any contact with any Obama fundraisers and said he was not pressured by the White House to speed up the loan process. Chu argued that if the country pulls its support for clean energy companies, even risky ones, that will mean ceding the technology race to places like China. He told members that last year alone, China offered $34 billion in subsidies to its clean tech companies.
In the coming decades, the clean energy sector is expected to grow by hundreds of billions of dollars. We're in a fierce global race to capture this market.
But Republicans kept hammering away at the particulars of the Solyndra loan. Here, Tennessee Republican Marsha Blackburn.
Let me ask you this. Why did you allow that company to continue to pull down millions of taxpayer dollars after you discovered the financial problems in that company?
Okay. That's an excellent question. The loan was to build a factory. The factory was half built.
Chu said restructuring the loan gave taxpayers the best chance of recovering the most money. But this decision was where Republicans issued their harshest criticism. Renegotiating the loan meant private investors would get paid ahead of taxpayers if Solyndra failed. And Louisiana Republican Steve Scalise accused Chu of violating the law by subordinating taxpayers.
Does the taxpayer have first dibs on the $535 million?
At the time of the,
when the first dollar comes in from Solyndra, if one even does?
At the time of the original loan.
That's a yes or no question.
Right now, after.
Yes or no, Mr. Secretary?
Chu eventually conceded no. As it turns out, this may be a moot point. While Chu testified, Solyndra asked the bankruptcy court to push back its auction for the second time. It hasn't received any bids for its assets. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
It's 12:43. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. In Big Ten football tomorrow, Penn State plays Ohio State in Columbus. Football has long been king at Penn State, and the program is one of the most lucrative in the country. But as the biggest scandal in the school's history continues to roil the campus, some in State College, Pennsylvania, are beginning to question football's influence. NPR's Joel Rose reports from State College.
At his press conference this week, interim Penn State football coach Tom Bradley tried to focus on tomorrow's game in Columbus.
It's still Ohio State, Penn State. This is all about the players. This is about our team. It's about their team. It's still football, great atmosphere, college football, and it'll be a very spirited match regardless of what's going on outside.
What's going on outside is the biggest scandal in the history of Penn State and maybe college football, period. It's already brought down legendary football coach Joe Paterno and university president Graham Spanier. Still, interim coach Bradley said he would not rule out a possible postseason bowl game appearance for his team.
Players and the guys on this team didn't have anything to do with any of this that's surrounding them. There was rumors swirling around that if we make it, that we won't be able to go to a bowl game. I told him that was untrue.
Football is a huge source of pride for Penn State and a big source of revenue, too. According to the Department of Education, the football team brought in more than $70 million during the 2009-2010 season.
This is only the tip of the iceberg. The big money that Penn State generates from its football program actually relates to its fundraising.
Mark Gannis is president of consulting firm Sports Corp Limited. He says Penn State used its winning football program, epitomized by coach Joe Paterno, to raise hundreds of millions of dollars.
He is used at alumni events. He is used to meet with big donors, people who are big contributors to the university and not just the athletic department.
Those dollars literally helped to build Penn State from a remote agricultural school into a major research university. Football helped enrich local businesses, too. But critics say those dollars also silenced debate about the growing power and secrecy of the football program. Peter Buckland grew up in State College. His father taught English at Penn State for 35 years. Now Buckland is a grad student here.
People have this kind of consciousness that they think they're not supposed to say anything bad about football. You could say, oh, the team isn't doing any good or this or that, but you can't criticize the structure of football, the institution of football. You know, it's kind of like making fun of Jesus.
Though even Buckland admits that the team's reputation for high academic standards is well-deserved. Former coach Paterno donated money to the campus library that bears his name. And many students at Penn State still see the football program as a force for good. Senior Michael El Sala is president of the Student Athlete Advisory Board and a member of the men's fencing team.
As a fencer with a smaller sport, a non-revenue sport, I mean, majority of a lot of sports on campus, including mine, run solely on the football program. Most people on the campus love football. It's something to be proud of.
But there are those on campus who think that love for Penn State football goes too far.
The central thing for many of the students is football, football culture, tailgating. I think it's out of balance.
Mindy Kornhaber is a professor at Penn State's College of Education. She hopes the current crisis will lead to some soul searching at Penn State.
There's a reorientation that could happen as a result of this, where the academic side of this really strong university gets bolstered and the football side, which isn't inherently bad, takes its proper role and gets in proper perspective.
Kornhaber says the initial signs from the university's interim administration are hopeful, but she says a real debate about the role of football in campus life has yet to begin. Joel Rose, NPR News, State College, Pennsylvania.
Director Martin Scorsese's movie Hugo is about a boy living in a Paris train station. It's also a Valentine to early filmmaker and magician Georges Méliès.
Basically, he painted all the sets and the costumes. He wrote the stories himself. And all of this came from his idea of how to create illusions on film.
Martin Scorsese on creating some illusions of his own in 3D. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Hey, how'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing? Going into the paving business once again?
No, it's Car Talk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station, and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web.
To learn more, call 866-789-8627.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 18th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of the novelist and poet Margaret Atwood, born 1939 in Ottawa, Ontario. Her father, an entomologist, she spent a good deal of her childhood out in the woods with him as he did field work. Margaret Atwood said, "I grew up in the woods, outside of any social structures apart from those of my family, so I didn't absorb social structures through my skin the way many children do. If you grow up in a small town, you instinctively know who is who and what is what, and whom you can safely be contemptuous of." It was on this day, 1883, standard time zones were established in the United States and Canada. 4 time zones, 1 hour of solar time for each 15 degrees of longitude. Before that, towns and cities set their own time and drove people crazy, particularly the railroads. It's the birthday of the man who wrote, "I am the very model of a modern major general. I have information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical. I understand equations, both the simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot